Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And as usual, at the beginning of our TBJ, we read from the biz page in this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of Fresh Ideas comes the article, Initiative Explores How Businesses Can Help Families. A new effort is looking to help North Carolina businesses meet the needs of families and show why that's important to employers and bottom lines. The North Carolina Early Childhood Foundation initiative includes a 10-member advisory council with Dr. Betsy Tilson, the state health director, and Farah Palumbo, chief people officer of Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. Surveys and meetings across the state will collect ideas that will go into a toolkit for businesses with advice on how to create family-friendly workplaces. We're looking to get a diversity of opinion, said Tracy Zimmerman, the foundation's executive director. She says the timing is important, with millennials seeking a work-life balance and the strong economy making it hard to retain talent. Zimmerman says the business response has been largely positive. They realized these types of things were good for families and good for business. I was impressed. And under the heading of Good Cause comes the article, Shooting Down Teen Cancer. You can take your shot at Cameron Indoor Stadium, and all for a good cause later this month, when Teen Cancer America holds the second TCA Hoopathon in Durham. Nolan Smith, a former Duke University hoop star, who is now the school's director of basketball operations, will lead an event that's expected to include players from Duke, UNC Chapel Hill, and the NBA. The event has 300 slots open for shooters who get 3 minutes to fire away from designated spots on the floor. The teen cancer effort was actually begun by Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend of The Who in 2012. The initiative supports hospitals and healthcare professionals who are helping teens battling cancer. And under the heading of Coming to DPAC, the article Elf Musical will have an autism-friendly show. Buddy the Elf had it right when he said in the Christmas classic, I just like to smile. Smiling's my favorite. The lead character from the movie Elf was all about sharing the joy of Christmas and elf culture. And the Durham Performing Arts Center is channeling the joy of the holiday season on December the 8th with a special autism-friendly performance of Elf the Broadway Musical. The production is tailored to accommodate guests by having less loud noises and flashing lights, and dedicated quiet and support areas for those who wish to step out during the show. Tickets go on sale August the 4th. This is DPAC's second autism-friendly performance. The venue hosted a special performance of Dr. Seuss' How the Grinch Stole Christmas in 2016. And in some sad news, under the heading of Remembered, comes sad news on one of the Triangle's entrepreneurial leaders. Serial entrepreneur Larry Steffen, former general manager of Wake Forest's Wireless Research Center, died on 30 July. Steffen co-founded early American underground tenant Joystick Labs. He often touted the region's potential to be a leader in the interest of things future. Leader in the Internet of Things future. At his latest initiative in Wake Forest, his goal was to create mutual momentum between entrepreneurs and that town. The companies we are incubating our facilities will create numerous high-growth job opportunities and return for our community, he said in 2013. 2 years later, he would equate a testing device at the center to standing in a spaceship. The room, which housed a CTIA test lab funded by the Golden Leaf Foundation, would draw entrepreneurs, he said then. In order to keep people here, you need a world-class testing facility, he said. And under the heading of Done Deal comes the article, Raleigh Firm Expands in Pittsburgh with Acquisition. McKim & Creed Incorporated, one of the largest engineering, geomatics, and planning firms in the Triangle, snapped up Pittsburgh-based Loftus Engineers, LLC, in a deal that closed July 31st. Going forward, Loftus Engineers will provide service to clients as Loftus Engineers, a McKim & Creed company. Terms of the deal were not disclosed. Loftus Engineers employs 37 and provides mechanical, electrical, plumbing, structural, and energy services. McKim & Creed employs a total of 500 and is headquartered in Raleigh. It has 20 offices throughout North Carolina, Florida, Virginia, Georgia, Texas, and Pennsylvania. Combining McKim & Creed's strengths with those of Loftus enables us to offer more of our services in the Pittsburgh area and supports our current and growing Pittsburgh office, stated John Lucy, president and CEO of McKim & Creed. We're excited to significantly grow our engineering business in the dynamic Western Pennsylvania market. And winding up our reading of the biz page under the heading of new owners comes the article Durham's Artsy 21C sold as part of acquisition of the Hotel Group. A downtown Durham hotel that combines fine art with luxury lodging is part of a major acquisition by an international hospitality company. 21C Museum Hotels of Louisville, Kentucky, which owns and operates its namesake location in Durham, has sold an 85% stake in its company to Accor Hotels, a firm with more than 4,500 lodging properties in 100 countries. The deal is valued at $51 million, and staff say they were notified of the acquisition July 31st. Founded in 2006 by Louisville philanthropists and art collectors Laura Lee Brown and Steve Wilson, 21C Museum Hotels has 8 locations and 3 more under development. The founders will maintain a 15% ownership stake in the company. 21C CEO Craig Greenberg will stay in his post as well. With the deal complete, 21C Museum Hotels will now fall under Accor Hotels M Gallery brand of boutique hotels and will be the first in that collection in the U.S., according to a press release. Accor Hotels began in France in 1967. Development of the hotel in Durham began with the company's acquisition of the former SunTrust building at 111 North Corcoran Street downtown. The firm underwent a massive renovation and restoration project to revamp the building, funded in part by nearly $8 million in incentives from the city and Durham County. Now we turn to this week's Tech and Transportation page. And under the heading of Bringing Jobs comes the article, Panel Outlines How NC Can Attract Foreign Investment. A year after Indian IT firm Infosys announced a 2,000 job tech hub in Raleigh, the company is working to meet its first hiring milestone this year of 500 people. Dennis Gatta, regional head of financial services and insurance at Infosys, says the firm now has about 250 employees at an office in Briar Creek. Gatta and other experts on foreign direct investment spoke at a recent Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce panel on foreign investments. The key takeaway? Advocacy. Panelists asked the crowd to advocate for international flights, affordable housing, and education. But the biggest thing the Triangle can do is maintain its university-driven talent pool, Gatta says. Most of our work that we do is very transformational work, and it's getting more complex, he said. And under the heading of Growth Plans comes the article Mati names former Coke executive its new CEO. 6 months after the departure of founding CEO Tatiana Birgerson, Durham's Mati Energy has named a new leader. Eric Masters, a Mati investor who has served in marketing positions at several companies, including Coca-Cola, takes over as CEO. His goal is to take the brand national and accelerate the growth. Certainly nationally and potentially internationally, it's already become one of the leading brands in the category in Whole Foods, in the natural channel of the southeastern U.S., Masters says. And under the heading of Aviation comes the article, Delta Executive Sees Even More Potential for Airline at RDU. Delta Airlines' growth plan for Raleigh-Durham International Airport involves bigger planes, more frequency, and Salt Lake City. At the recent Regional Transportation Alliance 2018 Transportation Breakfast, Joe Esposito, Delta's Senior Vice President of Network Planning, addressed the carrier's West Coast strategy. With the recently announced nonstop to Chicago, he said, "We serve now the majority of your big business markets. Now it will be more flights per day to those cities, bigger airplanes, more amenities, he said. Increasing frequency to Salt Lake City is top of mind, he added, as it connects to Delta's entire West Coast network. Atlanta has West connectivity. Detroit has West connectivity. But Salt Lake City serves all these West markets, he explained. While new cities are in Delta's future plans, he said, we've got a little more service to go in the West before we hit Portland. You're off to a great start in Paris, Esposito said, a nod to the nonstop from RDU to Charles de Gaulle Airport that debuted in 2016. It's not unreasonable to get more service in the future. More service will likely be the result of partnerships, he said. RDU's nonstop to Paris flight, for example, is a result of its collaboration with Air France KLM. 70% of the Raleigh passengers connect in Paris, so that service wouldn't be successful without the partnership. And Esposito said multiple examples exist. Delta's 49% ownership stake in Virgin Group gave it great access into London Heathrow. And a joint venture with Korean Air allows for greater expansion in Asia. RDU, even without a nonstop to most of these markets, benefits through connectivity, he said. And finally, on this week's Tech and Transportation page, under the heading of Public Documents, comes the article, Clues Make Case for Amazon Center. Recently filed documents for Project Access, a 2,000-job fulfillment center planned for Garner, include clues that the mystery tenant is likely Amazon. A building permit application with the town of Garner lists Marietta, Georgia-based The Conlin Company, which joins developer Hillwood Investment Properties, listed in previous filings. Both firms have done past work for Amazon. They, along with Atlanta firm McGregor Associates Architects, also linked to Amazon projects, are listed in the building permit application filed July 24th for a $166 million four-story warehouse distribution facility. The electrical work alone is estimated to cost nearly $11.5 million, with mechanical and plumbing an additional $5 million and $1.7 million, respectively. Town officials have not said that it's Amazon, nor have the companies, who either declined to comment or did not return phone calls. But state permit applications show a 2,000-job project is planned at the site, and Hillwood told state regulators last month the facility would become one of the largest taxpayers and by far the largest employer in the town. A new table-sized book of construction designs, solely housed within the Garner Planner and Inspections Department walls, offers more clues, such as the colors of a concrete monument sign that will one day be visible from the highway. The colors, orange, white, squid ink, heron gray, and mindful gray, appear similar to Amazon's logo palette. And the document calls for Smile, acrylic push-through graphics. Amazon includes a smile in its logo. The project's address is 4851 John Sausage Road in Garner, the old ConAgra Slim Jim plant, the site of a deadly explosion nearly a decade ago. The players? Well, the developer is Hillwood. The company was started by Ross Perot Jr., son of the former presidential candidate, and has developed projects for Amazon in multiple states. The contractor? The Conlin Company. The Atlanta company has worked on multiple Amazon projects and worked with Hillwood before. Finally, the plan designer, McGregor Architect Associates. The Atlanta company plans, designs, and delivers a wide range of office and industrial projects, including fulfillment centers. Now we move to the Life Sciences page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And the heading of Major Change, the article is entitled, Why Blue Cross is Lowering ACA Rates. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina wants to lower its Affordable Care Act rates by an average of 4.1%. The state's largest insurer made the announcement July 31st, calling it BCBSNC's first rate decrease since entering the current individual market more than 25 years ago. We went to providers and asked for a fee-for-service rate decrease, plus the ability to engage in a two-sided joint accountability model based on value, CEO Dr. Patrick Conway says. Through those actions, we were able to decrease the rates and have a model that we think will control medical costs into the future. Conway says other competitors were not a catalyst for filing for the decrease. The primary driver for our rates is how do we cover the medical costs and our administrative costs, he said. We'll always strive for the lowest possible rates for our customers. Conway is pushing for more alternative payment models aimed at lowering the rising costs of health care. BCBSNC says the factors contributing to filing are, 1, more information about customers, 2, savings from the 2017 Tax Act, 3, Congress's one-year suspension of the ACA's health insurer tax, and 4, new deals with health systems. But the company says, had the federal government not eliminated the individual mandate penalty, requested rates would be another 4% lower. If federal cost-sharing reduction payments to insurers that were eliminated as of October 2017 were still in place, requested rates would be another 14% lower. BCBSNC lost more than $450 million on ACA plans its first 3 years. But in March, it said that after years of those losses, it reported a higher-than-anticipated net income margin in 2017 at 7.8 cents for every dollar of revenue. And under the heading of cash on hand comes the article, What's Next for Liquidia After a NASDAQ Debut? Research Triangle Park-based Liquidia closed its IPO on July 30th with gross proceeds of $50 million. The company said it has granted underwriters a 30-day option to purchase about 680,000 additional shares of common stock, which could yield about $7.5 million more for the company if fully exercised. Proceeds from Liquidia's IPO will largely be used to complete the company's Phase 3 trial of its product candidate LIQ861 for the treatment of pulmonary arterial hypertension, a disease caused by the narrowing of arteries that can often lead to heart failure. This offering is obviously a great step forward for patients, says Liquidia CEO Neil Fowler. We're currently in that Phase 3 study, and it is enrolling well. Along with completing the study in the first half of next year, proceeds from the IPO will prepare Liquidia for a new drug application, that's an NDA, submission to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration by the end of 2019. And, adds Fowler, we're beginning to think through the commercialization of the product. In May, Liquidia recruited a new commercial executive, Jerry Thomas, with sights set on potential FDA approval. Thomas was most recently Senior Vice President of Strategic Group Planning at New York healthcare marketing agency Harrison and Starr. Other proceeds from the company's IPO will be used to advance another product candidate, LIQ865, for postoperative pain relief, preparing it to be ready for Phase 2 in 2019, says Fowler. Liquidia currently employs about 60. The company's common stock commenced trading on the NASDAQ exchange July 26 under the ticker LQDA. Now we move to the real estate page of this week's TBJ. And under the heading of commercial space comes the article, Co-working company WeWork wants to at least triple its footprint in the Triangle. WeWork has office space locked up in two of the Triangle's most prominent office buildings currently under construction. But those leases, totaling more than 139,000 square feet, are just the beginning for the fast-growing co-working company's plans in the region. WeWork Southeast General Manager Bobby Condon declined to provide specifics on how well the company's current spaces have been leasing, but he says WeWork plans to at least triple its footprint in the Triangle in the next 18 months. We're always looking for opportunities in perpetuity in markets that we believe in, Condon says. WeWork plans to open in the coming months at the One City Center Tower in downtown Durham and the One Glenwood Building in Raleigh, both of which are still under construction. Reaching Condon's goal would mean adding another 420,000 square feet of office space by the end of next year. For context, the 27-story One City Center building has a total of 130,000 square feet of office space. The Triangle is just the latest region WeWork has eyed for rapid growth since its founding in 2010. armed with highly amenitized office space and backed by billions in investment from Japan's SoftBank, the company has pegged its valuation at $20 billion, although a recent analysis by the Financial Times puts that number closer to $3 billion. WeWork's triangle push comes at the same time that competitor Spaces is signing new leases from Raleigh to Durham and beyond. The International Working Group brand plans to move into 52,000 square feet at the 555 Mangum building in Durham and 34,000 square feet in the Center Green 3 building in Cary, adding to its presence at the Dillon Tower and the Station at East 54 building in Chapel Hill. And under the heading of Hot Area comes the article, Downtown Raleigh's Building Boom Continues in the Second Quarter of 2018. A handful of high-profile development projects that have officially been completed and are now open in downtown Raleigh in 2018 have pushed the total completed investment in the area to a five-year high. Among the buildings now open are the 18-story The Dillon Tower build by Kane Realty Group in the Warehouse District, and Raleigh's new Union Station, all part of a $274 million surge in completed projects coming online this year, according to the Downtown Raleigh Alliance. The last time completed projects surpassed that dollar amount in a single year was in 2013, when the total investment reached $343 million. We've been in the middle of this $1.75 billion pipeline. This is a big chunk of it being completed, says Bill King, Downtown Raleigh Alliance's Senior Vice President of Economic Development and Planning. The construction news is part of a more in-depth second quarter report by the DRA that paints a bright picture of the city's development across the board, from restaurant openings to the vacancy rates in office buildings. The numbers from April to June show a slight uptick in new openings for eateries and retailers in downtown Raleigh. The second quarter saw the opening of the Wahlburgers and the new Bishop's Cuts and Color below the Dillon, in addition to 10 other new storefront business openings. Six businesses closed shop. And along with this article is a graph showing the rapid rise for Raleigh in the value of completed construction projects by year from 2011 to 2018. So in 2011, $22.3 million completed. In 2012, $160 million. In 2013, of course, the high of $343 million. In 2014, about half that with $115 million. In 2015, $260 million. In 2016, $174 million. In 2017, $75 million. And, of course, this year in 2018, $274 million. And finally, from the real estate page of this week's TBJ, under the heading of Developing comes this article. It's a small sidebar that I can't resist reading. NC State parking lot sells for $12 million and work is underway. A popular tailgating parking lot near NC State University's Carter Finley Stadium has been sold for $12.39 million and work is already underway at the site on a new student housing development. The project is one of two that recently broke ground in Raleigh by developer Landmark Properties of Athens, Georgia. The Standard at Raleigh, a 234-unit, 707-bed development, is starting to take shape near campus at the former North Carolina Equipment Company property at 3101 Hillsborough Street. The parking lot development has been dubbed The Station and will be the cottage-style community with 658 beds spread through 174 homes, according to Landmark. Floor plans for the project on Trinity Road give each resident a private bathroom. The Station is on track to be completed in 2019. The Standard, which includes nearly 6,000 square feet of commercial space, is expected to deliver the following year, according to the company. Now we turn to a short article on the On Business Trends page on salaries, and the article is entitled Triangle Wage Growth Underperforms. The median wage growth for Triangle employees has underperformed growing inflation dating back to 2011. Overall, Raleigh's median annual wages grew 9.43%, and Durham's median annual wages grew 8.9% between 2011 and 2017, according to data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. But during that time period, BLS says the nation's consumer price index, CPI, increased 13.33%. Now, the CPI tracks the change in the prices of goods that consumers pay from month to month. So the core CPI includes all items except for volatile food and energy costs. Wages and inflation typically have a strong correlation. As one rises, so does the other, according to the Federal Reserve of St. Louis. If wages increase faster than inflation, that increases the buying power of consumers, according to Glassdoor Economic Research. But if inflation outpaces wages, the higher cost of goods makes it more expensive for consumers to buy products. The triangle's highest paid occupations generally saw the largest pay increases, while the lowest paid employees saw a negative or stagnant wage growth. Many jobs on both ends of the spectrum underperformed against the rising cost of living, but considerably more of the lowest paid occupations performed worse against the CPI change. Furthermore, those in the least paid occupations saw lower percentage pay increases, and a greater number of occupations saw underperforming growth. This segment also has a much larger number of employees, meaning more in the community will be affected by higher costs of living. More than 57,000 residents are employed in the 15 lowest paid jobs in the triangle, while 17,620 people are employed in the 15 highest paid occupations. And in a brief article from Around the State, this week's Around the State page comes from the Triad Business Journal, and the article is entitled Major NC Furniture Firm Files for Bankruptcy. High Point-based Heritage Home Group has filed for bankruptcy and said it has found buyers for its three remaining business segments. HHG's parent company, that's HH Global 2 BV, and its U.S. affiliates, filed petitions in the U.S. Bankruptcy Court in Delaware to begin restructuring to support the sale. There will be an auction in the next 60 days, but HHG said it has identified potential buyers that will demonstrate the highest and best value for the assets, along with the ability to invest in and support their growth. One of them is RHF Investments, owner of furniture brands Century, Hancock & Moore, and Highland House. The company has signed an agreement to buy HHG's luxury business, which includes the Hickory Chair, Maitland Smith, and Pearson brands. The sale also would include operations in Hickory related to the luxury business segment. The company did not disclose terms. HHG also said it has signed a letter of intent and is in final negotiations with an unnamed company that will buy the Thomasville & Company and Broyhill businesses. Company spokeswoman Sydney Isaacs said HHG has approximately 190 employees in the High Point area. The company also employs 775 people in Lenoir and 450 people in Hickory. HHG has 1,520 employees in the U.S. The company said it expects no material changes in operations. Employees will continue to be paid. Customers will get their deliveries, and suppliers will be paid for goods and services provided after the bankruptcy filing, HHG said. Robert Albergati, interim chief financial officer and managing director at Alix Partners LLP, has been named chief restructuring partner. With the creation of our more focused Broyhill, Thomasville & Company, and luxury business units in late 2017, our Lane and Lane Venture businesses were designated for divestiture, and we were fortunate to find excellent trade buyers for each in United Furniture and Bassett Furniture, respectively, he said. Now we turn to this week's cover story, which is entitled, Triangle Plunges into Transformational Science. For one, out of every 3,500 male babies born, there is a debilitating disease lurking known as DMD. DMD, or Duchenne muscular dystrophy, is a rare genetic disease that primarily affects boys. Its symptoms usually emerge in children between the ages of 3 and 5 and include progressive muscle degeneration across the body, as well as the heart and respiratory system. But Pfizer has DMD on its radar, and the pharmaceutical giant is building a new weapon to attack it, a gene therapy out of North Carolina. Earlier this year, the New York-based company made a critical step in its gene therapy program less than 2 years after its acquisition of Bamboo Therapeutics of Chapel Hill and a deal worth up to $645 million. Bob Smith, Pfizer's senior vice president and leader of the company's gene therapy business, says the company has initiated its first new clinical trial from the Bamboo acquisition. The trial is for a gene therapy candidate that could slow or even stop DMD. "We're really hopeful this will prove to be a transformational new therapy for boys suffering from the disease," Smith says. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is watching closely as the new gene therapy technologies take root. According to the FDA, gene therapy is where scientists replace a gene that causes a medical problem with one that doesn't, adds genes to help the body to fight or treat disease, or turns off genes that are causing problems. While there are less than a handful of gene therapy products approved by the FDA, it's a potentially lucrative and life-changing market. Allied Market Research says the global gene therapy market could surge from roughly $600 million now to more than $4.4 billion in just 5 years. Now, Bamboo Therapeutics was founded by Jude Samulski out of UNC Chapel Hill in 2014. And with Bamboo Therapeutics leading the way, there are roughly 20 players now in North Carolina targeting the likes of cancer, metabolic disorders, and ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. They're coming from both Triangle universities as well as from out of state, and have the potential to bring tax and economic development benefits as a defined North Carolina-based cluster develops. Even with challenges such as bringing payers on board and the high cost of manufacturing, there's a great opportunity for North Carolina, says Kate Holt, Senior Director of Investments at the North Carolina Biotechnology Center. That opportunity doesn't only consist of the creation of jobs, she says, but also a tax base for the state and a new area of expertise in which to shine and become a global leader. It's a great goal, she says, and it's a worthy goal. Smith says Pfizer started investing in the gene therapy space about 4 years ago. Since that time, academic work out of North Carolina and continued development of Pfizer's gene therapy program in the state have remained of critical importance. "We had a view that this was an area of science that could translate into the potential for transformational medicines for patients," Smith says, with a particular focus on rare diseases. The approach, he says, was to build, buy, and partner. Smith points to Samulski as a leading academic investigator in the space. Soon after Samulski founded Bamboo, he reached out to Pfizer. Ultimately, Pfizer invested $45 million in Bamboo's Series A funding round, and the agreement included an option to acquire the company at a subsequent date, says Smith, assuming certain milestones were met. August 1st marked the two-year anniversary of Pfizer's acquisition of Bamboo, with clinical work now underway. "Since we completed the acquisition, we've significantly expanded on manufacturing capabilities," Smith says. "That includes a $100 million, 40-job gene therapy manufacturing expansion in Sanford, announced last year. We feel really good about the prospects of the Bamboo acquisition, the way that it has been managed in the 2 years since we completed it, and the promising pipeline of candidates based on technology programs," he says. Judith Cohn, Vice Chancellor for Innovation, Entrepreneurship, and Economic Development at UNC, calls Pfizer's continued investment in the region a signal. "They would not put their plant here if they weren't also trying to be close to the science," she says. Much of that science, as in the case of Bamboo, is coming out of the area's universities. Bill Bullock, Senior Vice President of Economic Development and Statewide Operations at NC Biotech, notes that $1 of every $9 in NIH rare disease research funding flows through North Carolina. Universities across the state, including UNC, Duke, NC State, Wake Forest, and East Carolina, are all attracting that funding. "We have a long-standing commitment to that field from our research institutions, including UNC's Gene Therapy Center, and the work of Samulski and his colleagues, as well as Duke's enhanced efforts in the space," says Clay Thorpe, a partner at Hatteras Venture Partners, which is invested in the gene therapy space. "Spinoffs from universities have grown," he says, "and Pfizer's manufacturing base is a big win for the area. UNC started its gene therapy center in 1993, and emerged as a pioneer in a type of gene therapy known as adeno-associated virus, sometimes abbreviated AAV, viral vector therapy, notes Kelly Parsons, Associated Director of Technology Commercialization. Along with Pfizer Bamboo, other companies attempting to move research out of UNC and into the clinic include the likes of Corrigen Biopharmaceutics of Research Triangle Park and Stride Bio of Durham. This summer, Stride Bio said it had banked $15.7 million in its Series A round, led by locally based Hatteras Venture Partners. The funding closely followed a collaboration agreement with Switzerland's CRISPR Therapeutics and Casebia Therapeutics, a joint venture between CRISPR and Bayer AG. Stride Bio was founded in 2015 out of technology from the labs of Ira Vandasakan at UNC Chapel Hill and Mavis Agbanji McKenna at the University of Florida. Asokan, also among the scientific funding term at Bamboo, joined the Duke School of Medicine earlier this year as the new director of gene therapy in its division of surgical sciences. There continues to be an academic expertise in the area when it comes to the gene therapy space, says Richard Smith, chief operating officer at Stride Bio. Locus Biosciences was formed in 2015 out of research work at NC State. The company focused on developing technologies to fight bacterial infections that resist antibiotics has since attracted major treatment dollars. That includes about $24 million over the course of last year from the likes of Chinese tech titan Tencent and West Coast-based Artis Ventures. Increasingly, says Stride Bio Smith, there's money coming in from companies who are looking to get into gene therapy. Gene therapy company AVXS recently celebrated the wall breaking of its new Durham facility, where the Illinois company expects to bring 200 manufacturing jobs to the Triangle with an annual payroll rising to more than $20 million. AVXS is receiving state and local incentives for the Durham expansion, which is expected to grow the state's economy by just shy of $920 million, according to Governor Roy Cooper's office. A state job development investment grant is slated to provide up to about $2.2 million in reimburses to AVXS over 12 years. In 2015, AVXS acquired gene therapy technology from Asclepios Biopharmaceutical of Chapel Hill. In shifting to the Triangle, Andrew Newton, Senior Vice President of Technical Operations and Chief Technical Officer of AVXS, says, "We certainly did consider expanding operations in the Chicago area as well, but there's a rich history in the Raleigh-Durham area around biologics production." AVXS, acquired by Novartis for $8.7 billion, is developing treatments for spinal muscular atrophy, sometimes called SMA, a leading genetic cause of infant mortality, as well as for Rett syndrome, an autism spectrum disorder. The company is also targeting ALS. A primary goal for the company, Knudsen said, was additional manufacturing capacity that geographically diversified our operations. Knudsen says, "An already well-established biotech hub, the further development of this cluster will continue to draw highly specialized talent to the area. There are a number of similarities between biologics manufacturing and gene therapy manufacturing," he says, adding, "We plan to continue to leverage the strengths of that common expertise." While AVXS plans to submit a biologics license application to the FDA for its lead gene therapy candidate for the treatment of SMA in the third quarter, the company isn't the only out-of-state entrant to North Carolina's gene therapy cluster recently. Last year, Bluebird Bio of Cambridge, Massachusetts, said it would fly south to Durham for its third U.S. site. Bluebird went public in 2013, raising about $116 million, and trades on the NASDAQ exchange. Derek Adams, Chief Technology and Manufacturing Officer, says the company expects to expand to about 50 people in Durham over the next couple of years. For its Triangle expansion, Bluebird, which is developing a pipeline of gene therapy products for the treatment of genetic diseases and cancer, acquired the roughly 125,000-square-foot manufacturing site at 1733 T.W. Alexander Drive for about $11.4 million, according to Durham County Deed Records. As part of our manufacturing strategy we've been working on executing over the last year or so, we decided that we need both internal manufacturing efforts and external partnerships, Adams says. Along with North Carolina, Bluebird considered Massachusetts and Maryland and foreign locations for its new facility. But Durham provided a significant talent pool, convenient access to the company's headquarters in Cambridge, and a facility that fits with the company's timeline. Also, research talent from local universities and a rising gene therapy community contributed to Bluebird's selection of Durham, the company says. Financial support from NC Biotech includes up to $100,000 for job creation milestones. To date, the FDA has approved just 3 gene therapies, and all came last year. The latest was awarded to Spark Therapeutics in Philadelphia for the treatment of inherited vision loss. I believe gene therapy will become a mainstay in treating and maybe curing many of our most devastating and intractable diseases, said FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb in a statement at the time of the approval, adding, "We're at a turning point when it comes to this novel form of therapy and at the FDA. We're focusing on establishing the right policy framework to capitalize on this scientific opening." The FDA followed through on those remarks by issuing new guidance, but there are still significant challenges. Hatteras's Thorpe says, "North Carolina is a top-tier location when it comes to gene therapy, competing with Boston and San Francisco. While North Carolina has kept pace in terms of manufacturing, there's more investment needed." Thorpe says companies normally think about manufacturing later. But with the complexities of gene therapy, he says, that has to be thought of sooner. Traditional pharmaceutical manufacturing grew into biologics manufacturing, which grew more and more complex, says NC Biotech's Bullock. At each inflection point, North Carolina kept pace with advances in science, manufacturing, supporting services, and talent. Now, says Bullock, when gene and cell therapies are the cutting edge of medicine, North Carolina's foundation is again ready to propel these therapies toward market. This happened because of 3 decades of attention to building research infrastructure, pushing the right programs in place to train talent, and nurturing technologies on their winding path to market. Hatteras recently led Stride Bio's Series A round, and Stride Bio plans to complete clinical manufacturing internally, says Thorpe. We've hired the right talent for it. Gene therapy companies need to do this type of manufacturing in areas where you can scale it, and North Carolina is definitely one of those areas, he adds. There's also the challenge of bringing payers on board, says Holt of NC Biotech. She says, the health insurance industry and pharma companies are coming to the table around performance-based payments. One example may include negotiating for reimbursement when it comes to patients' responses to gene therapies, according to Holt. As the technologies mature, international competition is expected to be strong. North America is the highest contributor in the gene therapy market in 2016. However, Asia-Pacific is expected to witness the highest growth rate during the forecast period, states the February report from Allied Market Research. But whether large or small, the players in North Carolina's gene therapy space are optimistic. Pfizer Smith says the goal is to create therapies that can be commercialized and transformational for patients. We're hoping that the infrastructure and expertise that we built, in large part in North Carolina, is going to enable us to do that. Now we turn to this week's executive voice, which belongs to Dwayne Patterson. For nearly the past 4 decades, Dwayne Patterson has built up experience in a variety of leadership roles in and around the Triangle. That path has led him to positions such as Executive Director of Finance for Durham Public Schools, Chief Deputy Secretary at the NC Department of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, and most recently Chief Financial Officer at the NC Department of Natural and Cultural Resources. It's within that last umbrella that Patterson begins writing the next chapter in his professional story. He is now the director of the NC Division of Parks and Recreation, an entity that attracted more than 19 million visitors in 2017. Patterson, the first African-American to hold the post, leads a team that comprises 482 full-timers and a seasonal staff of 600, and he's leading their effort to manage more than 234,000 acres within North Carolina state parks, recreation areas, and natural areas. Triangle Business Journal caught up with him to learn about his plans for the statewide park system and how it seeks to maximize the visitor experience. So here's the Q&A. How has career progression led you to this role? For the past 30 years, I've served in a senior role in a variety of agencies, schools, mental health, museums, and juvenile justice. These experiences have honed my understanding that listening, learning, and implementing the ideas of staff and others are the keys to success. Additionally, my broad range of experiences helps me bring a strong knowledge and technical understanding of how to move an organization forward. All successful entities have the same base for good operations, management that listens, and treats staff with respect. Staffers who are committed and really think about how to do their job effectively and are allowed to self-actualize. And staffers who effectively communicate and exhibit confidence with a degree of humility in their work. Total attendance eclipsed 19 million for the 34 state parks and recreation areas in 2017, up 3% from the year before. To what do you attribute that steady increase in yearly attendance? Adding new campsites, trails, and access, increasing population in the state, and new people discovering the beauty of our parks, recreation areas, and trails. Also, we've increased our use of social media and programs such as the Passport Program and the 100 Mile Challenge. I recently signed up for the 100 Mile Challenge. Maybe everyone should join me. What's the current budget for the division? How are those dollars used? The total operating budget for NC Parks and Recreation is about $63 million, about half of which is used for salaries and other personnel costs. Another 25% is allocated for capital projects and major repairs. Another 13% is granted to local governments for local parks and coastal improvements. Of the remaining 17%, $6 million and $4.5 million are spent on utilities and supplies, all other expenses, respectively. What are some of the most exciting things on your calendar in the next few months? I plan to visit all the state parks and recreation areas within my first 3 months on the job and have one-on-one conversations with as many staffers as possible. Every time I visit a park, I understand why we have so much visitation. I'm truly excited about seeing them all. I also look forward to attending many of our groundbreaking, and ribbon-cutting events for projects made possible by the Connect NC Bond. What are the biggest challenges you see in the months ahead for the park system? Our attendance started to boom when the economy began to collapse and budgets were reduced and frozen. Since that time, we've seen unprecedented growth. Our staffing and maintenance must catch up with the attendance in order to maximize the visitor experience. I see a real opportunity for our park system to give North Carolina an unmatchable competitive advantage in attracting industry to our state. As land is a finite resource, we as a state must find a way to acquire and protect the remaining special natural resources that belong in our state park system. Finally, and importantly, a special goal of mine is to find a way that ensure that every North Carolina child has a lifelong, memorable experience at a local or state park. Hopefully, that experience will be the catalyst in them for healthy outdoor lifestyle and appreciation for our state's natural beauty. So what's the most important piece of advice you've been given in your career, and who gave it? Be a nice person, and don't act like management toward your staff. This was advice from my wife. What do you do to relax? Have one-on-one breakfast with either of my children. Well, it's relaxing most of the time. Now we turn to the small business page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and the article is Digital World Hogs a Great Deal of Energy. Many people associate technology with environmentalism. Developing the latest app is a lot cleaner than natural resource extraction, aka mining and drilling. Or is it? Or is our technology-based economy just extracting resources in different ways? For many years, the dirty little secret of the digital world has been that it takes a massive amount of energy to run our digital world. Silicon Valley likes to project a clean and green image, but the server farms that keep our digital world running consume vast amounts of electricity. The servers also generate heat, and more electricity is needed to air condition the server farms. Silicon Valley has managed to hide its energy dependence for a long time, but blockchain and coin mining operations are blowing its cover. Blockchain and coins and tokens utilize a worldwide development of computers organized into nodes. In an ordinary data network, data is stored on one server, but that opens the network to hacking. Blockchain networks protect data integrity by storing and processing the same data on thousands of computer nodes, but that massive duplication is an electricity hog. Of course, what's stored on the blockchain isn't necessarily raw data. The blocks usually contain hashes that represent the data. Hashes can turn huge amounts of data into much shorter strings of data. The common 256-character hash may represent millions of bits of information. The purpose of a hash isn't to give you instant access to all the information. The purpose is to allow you to verify the information by comparing hashes. If all 256 characters of two hashes match perfectly, you know they represent exactly the same data. The two biggest expenses of the people who operate the blockchain nodes are buying the computer hardware and paying the electric bills to operate them. This has substantially increased the demand for certain types of computers and for cheap electricity. Generally, electricity generated by dams is the cheapest source of electricity. This has set off a gold rush of miners who are building large coin mining operations close to hydroelectric power sources. That makes the Pacific Northwest America's coin mining capital. Increased demand for electric power competes with other industries and homes that also use electricity and the water that generates electric power. In some places, local towns have banned additional coin mining operations. There are running battles between locals, power companies, and miners. Allegedly, miners have been making threats to power companies. This reminds us of the range wars in the old Western movies where farmers, cattlemen, and sheep herders battled over access to water and grasslands. Will we have similar wars between coin miners and everyone else? Will Greens begin protesting big tech the way they oppose big oil and big coal? Stranger things have happened. Facebook used to be a popular company. Now, just about everyone is upset with Facebook about something. Who would have thought so many people would unfriend poor Mark Zuckerberg? And we get to the end of this week's TBJ, and we get to the viewpoint page. And this week's page features, as always, the editor's notebook, which is entitled, Here's Why Amazon Should Choose the Triangle. In 2017, Amazon, which is not really known for buying companies, bought 10 companies, easily exceeding the 5 deals it did in 2016 and 9 in 2015. It spent more than $14.5 billion in acquisitions last year, with Whole Foods being $13.7 billion of it. Here's another company Amazon should buy, Carrie's SaaS. Whoa, you say. Why would Amazon buy SaaS? When Amazon has shown it wants to grow its business organically and not by padding its revenue with a bunch of M&As. Because SaaS could be the engine to support all of Amazon's growth with predictive analytics across industries, business intelligence for future strategies, and inroads to the government sector. SaaS is into analytics software. It's the world's largest privately held software business, and its products are used by almost all of Fortune 500 companies. It has about 14,000 workers in 148 countries, 5,600 of them in Carrie, and finished 2017 with $3.24 billion in revenue. There's been no overture from SaaS founder Jim Goodnight to sell the company, but I've heard stories from former SaaS executives that Goodnight jokingly has said in the past that if someone offered him $20 billion, he would consider selling. Jeff Bezos didn't make his money by giving it away easily, but let's think about how an Amazon SaaS marriage makes sense. Maybe Goodnight's keeping this as a top secret, but we are getting no indication of a succession plan. Goodnight turned 75 in January. Some names in the past that had been floated to succeed him are no longer at the company. And I think Goodnight's founding partner, John Saul, age 70, simply is not interested in being the face of the company. Other tech megacore, such as Google, Apple, and Microsoft, are building their data analytics business. These companies are all buying companies left, right, and center to support their cloud businesses and strengthen business intelligence platforms. In the cloud, Amazon Web Services is still far ahead of, say, Google, which which has a $4 billion business compared to Amazon's $20 billion and Microsoft's $21 billion. But if Amazon is able to parlay SaaS's predictive analytics prowess and layer it over the different line of new businesses such as groceries, healthcare, and financial services, Bezos may have just another tool to determine the opportunities and challenges for his next buy. SaaS has a 900-acre campus, of which only 300 acres are developed. An HQ2 location in Cary may not be the urban center Bezos is looking for, but a company can build its own prime city on that much land. Goodnight did it himself when he bankrolled Preston Development to build a massive neighborhood that became the focal point of Cary's growth and the town's quality of living. Prestonwood was a game changer for Cary. Amazon can do the same, but this time with technology, transportation, and talent. One thing that may be different from Amazon is that the company always thinks 10 to 20 years ahead. Don't forget, Bezos started Amazon with his own money and contributions from friends and family. So when Bezos wants to buy a company, in his own words, he looks for four things. Customers love the company. The company can grow very large on its own. The return of capital is substantial, and the company stands the test of time, regardless of what its competition does. SaaS checks all those boxes. According to CB Insights, Amazon has bought 48 companies since 2010, and 32 of them are in the U.S. It's fair to say Amazon likes buying U.S. companies. CB Insights also adds that between 2013 and 2017, Amazon's compound annual sales growth rate is about 24%. That's from $74 billion in 2013 to $178 billion in 2017. And during that time, its stock price has gone up from $304 a share to $1,813 recently. Today, its market cap is reaching $1 trillion, yes, with a T. In 2013, the company's market cap was a mere $139 billion. So if Bezos is more than likely to laugh at SaaS's $20 billion acquisition value, could there be a way that Amazon can kill two birds with one stone? Hey, Alexa, how long does it take to fly from Seattle to Raleigh-Durham? Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be certain to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Once again, 919-832-5138.